welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Carolyn Donaldson. Now, chances are you've driven down Pew Street in State College at some point or another, or walked into Old Main on the campus of Penn State and marveled perhaps at those frescoes depicting the university's rich history, and noticed perhaps the bust of its first president, Evan Pugh. Until now, this young, energetic, educated, visionary story was largely untold. In today's Take Note, we're joined by Dr. Roger Williams, author of Evan Pugh's Penn State, America's Model Agricultural College. It is the first book-length treatment that's published by Penn State University Press of this mid-19th century scientist president who forged the nation's first successful higher education institution that was dedicated to scientific agriculture. That's very important, scientific agriculture, in what is now Penn State. Now, for those of you who are Penn State alums, Roger's name's likely very familiar. He served as Associate Vice President and Executive Director of the Penn State Alumni Association, the world's largest, from 2003 to 2015, and also he's been the Affiliate Associate Professor in Penn State's Higher Education Program for many years. Roger, thanks so much for joining us today.
Carolyn, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You know, I just finished reading your book, and I found it just fascinating and really inspirational. Released this spring, you explore the life and the contributions of this man, this founding president of what is today Penn State. This man led an unbelievable life, short but so impactful, and among other things, worked for the passage of the 1862 Morrill Act, which brought the national system of land-grant colleges, and wrote the nation's first organizational plan for those colleges, that roadmap, so that other institutions could get up and running. So Pugh did so much early in his life. Many things that are still the fabric of Penn State, and I know you outlined that, but Roger, I wanted to start with, why did you want to write a book about this extraordinary man?
Well, higher education history has always been my focus. And when I was doing my doctoral degree, for my dissertation, I wrote it on George Atherton, who was Penn State's seventh president from 1882 to 1904, and who's the person who really got this institution set on a successful course for the 20th century. But in the course of doing that research, I, of course, learned a lot about Evan Pugh, a fascinating person. I'd always wanted to write about him. When I came back here as executive director of the Alumni Association in 2003, I was going to start researching Evan Pugh. And I would tell my executive assistant, I'm going to the library on Monday mornings and I'll be in at noon. I got to get started. That lasted 3 weeks. The job was just overwhelming.
Sure.
So I had to wait until I retired in 2015. And a week after I retired, I was in the archives starting this project. So
you were disciplined like Evan Pugh.
I wish I had half of his discipline. I wish I could accomplish one-tenth of what he was able to do for Penn State. But it is an amazing story.
Well, let's start there. Let's start with a short synopsis of Pugh's early life, because, again, a Pennsylvania-born man, but his vision started so early of what he planned to do.
Sure. Let me give you a sense of how I see Evan Pugh. You're right. He did establish this institution, the Farmers High School, as it was then called, as the nation's first successful institution of higher learning dedicated to scientific agriculture. And Pugh's Agricultural College of Pennsylvania, as he later renamed it in 1862, set a very high academic standard. He graduated an inaugural class of 11 young men in 1861 with the nation's first Bachelor of Scientific Agriculture degrees. And you talked about Pugh's work in pushing for the Morrill Land-Grant College Act in 1862. You're quite right. He was very active in that campaign, and that's the legislation, the enabling legislation that led to a system of more than 105 land-grant colleges and universities across this country. He then quickly engineered the acceptance of the act by the Pennsylvania legislature. No small task at all, 9 months later. But a year later, after the legislature had voted to accept it, he found himself confronted by stiff political opposition in the legislature. They wanted to repeal the Acceptance Act and reapportion the Morrill Act proceeds to some additional colleges and other purposes. But Pugh's vision for scientific agriculture went well beyond Pennsylvania, Carolyn. He advocated for a large-scale national system. He wanted additional agricultural colleges modeled on his great experiment, as he called it, here at Penn State. Mm-hmm. You know, as Joe Paterno had his grand experiment, Evan mm-hmm. Pugh had his great experiment. He wanted to see also subordinate agricultural high schools. He wanted a strong federal Department of Agriculture. And he especially wanted to see agricultural research stations at these colleges across the country. He wanted the government to collect statistics on all things agricultural. But seeking to accelerate the development of the agricultural sciences in America, Pugh believed that the nation needed a model agricultural college at the apex of this system, hence his coming to Penn State.
Wow.
Now, a little bit about his background.
Yes.
To do all of this, Pugh prepared himself as a scientist. He was raised in a family of Welsh Quaker farmer blacksmiths in Chester County, Pennsylvania. In fact, Pugh was sixth generation of the Pugh family. His great-great-grandfather came here just a few years after William Penn founded Pennsylvania in 1862. Pugh patched together an education. He founded his own academy, which was geared toward science. In 1853, he left for advanced study in Germany. And after studying in Leipzig, he received his PhD in chemistry from the University of Göttingen in 1856. This was very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
So he moved eventually to the Rodhamsted Agricultural Experiment Station in England. And there he conducted a really elegant experiment that settled an international controversy on how plants assimilate nitrogen. From the air or from
Absolutely.
The soil? What's your guess?
Well, I remember reading that. I was thinking it was more from the soil.
You're right. You're exactly right. And his research earned him a fellowship in the London Chemical Society, but it also laid the foundations of the modern ammonium nitrate fertilizer industry. In fact, one of our professors here at Penn State said, had the Nobel Prize existed at the time he was doing this, he probably would have won it.
Why didn't he keep doing that then?
Well, his goal... even though his patrons in England wanted him to stay on and continue his research, his long-held goal was to develop, in his words, upon the soil of Pennsylvania, the best agricultural college in the world for the agricultural student of America. So he returned here in 1859 and proceeded to do exactly that. So this visionary with this driving sense of purpose, in the last year of his life, he developed an extensive organizational plan for colleges of agriculture and the mechanic arts, the land-grant colleges.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy is that Evan Pugh died young in April 1864 at age 36, the victim of the lingering effects of an accident, a crushing workload, and finally, typhoid fever.
Wow. You start the book out in such a wonderful way that I'd love for you to share with us how he arrived at this place that we call Happy Valley now.
Well, I set it up this way. He did arrive from Germany, came to his ancestral home in Oxford, Pennsylvania, in Chester County, and was in Philadelphia doing some things before he took the train. The scene is as follows. On a snowy, blustery day in late October 1859, Evan Pugh, Ph.D., set foot for the first time on the grounds of the Farmers High School in remote Center County, Pennsylvania. After leaving his ancestral home in Oxford, Chester County, he had taken the train from Philadelphia to the depot at Spruce Creek, a whistle-stop hamlet 22 miles west of campus. There he was met by school trustee Hugh McAllister, an attorney from Bellefonte, and taken by buggy to his destination. As they approached, Pugh saw a stark stone building, only one-third finished, a tall tower dominating a barren landscape. There were a few ramshackle outbuildings surrounded by muddy fields, including a gaping hole just to the southeast where limestone for the college building, as it was then called, was being quarried. No amenities, no comforts, only bone-hard work awaited.
That was how he came to this institution.
Indeed.
Unbelievable to have the foresight. And you were telling us a couple of side stories for those interested in what that looks like today. Paint the picture of where those items are today here at Penn State.
The college building, for example?
Yes.
Well, the college building has been replaced by what we call Old Main. The college building, it was completed in very late 1863, early 1864, and it lasted until 1929, when because of structural deficiencies, cracks, fissures, that sort of thing, it was actually torn down, dismantled. And the new Old Main that we now enjoy. This beautiful neoclassical building on our campus was erected in 1929-1930 using the same limestones that were quarried for the original college building. So Penn State was recycling before recycling was cool.
That's great. Well, back to Pew now. How did he actually become president?
Well, Pew, as I said, he became a schoolmaster. He founded his own academy in 1849, the Jordan Bank Academy, on his farm in Chester County. And he became friends with a number of leading lights in Chester County, scientists, botanists, physicians, the chief one being a man named William Darlington, an M.D., and actually one of the leading botanists in 19th century America. They formed a close friendship, and Darlington encouraged Pew to go abroad to study. He was very interested in agricultural science, which was very undefined at that time. It mm-hmm. had not really emerged as a definite, well-defined discipline. And there was no real graduate study in America at that time. If you wanted to learn agricultural chemistry or chemistry, the best culture in the world was in Germany, in the German states. And so Pew got himself, sold the family farm, and he had prospered as a schoolmaster at his own academy. So he took that money, and he left. He was gone for 6 years. So he went first to the University of Leipzig mm-hmm. and studied with some of the greatest chemists in the world. He then moved on to the University of Göttingen, where he got his Ph.D. He went to Heidelberg. He wanted to study with Robert Bunsen, and you probably know that name.
The Bunsen burner.
You got it. You got it. But Bunsen's lab was so oversubscribed, he was so popular, that Pew had to content himself with taking botanical tours. And in the summer of 1856, he happened upon an estate sale by a botanist who had died 2 years previous, and he bought it. He bought 3,000 specimens, which he eventually brought back here. Mm-hmm. They're still in our possession at the Pennsylvania Agricultural Herbarium, which is in Whitmore Lab. So,
isn't that fascinating? Yeah, his legacy lives on in that world.
It does. So, but during the time that he was away, he had made contacts with some of the trustees at the university, mm-hmm. The Farmers High School as it was being formed. And he signaled his interest in coming here as a professor. Sure. Later on as a president. And one thing led to another, and Frederick Watts, who was president of the Farmers High School Board of Trustees, pursued him, and serendipity occurred, and Pew was thrilled to get the invitation to come here in March 1859 as president of the Farmers High School, soon to become the Agricultural College of Pennsylvania.
So you paint that bleak picture of him arriving, and right from the start he established a very strict curriculum, very strict guide for the students. Explain the life of a student at the Farmer's School under Dr. Pugh's tutelage.
Yeah, well, the students. The school opened in February of 1859. I think there were 69 students who showed up, and they were nominated by their county agricultural societies. You know, we've got a good boy here. He's mm-hmm. a smart young man. There mm-hmm. were no women, I should point out, not at that point.
Sure.
So they came here, and they were subscribing to a fairly rigorous scientific curriculum. That was Pew's goal, and he set it up in such a way that they were studying everything from vegetable physiognomy to horticulture to chemistry, certainly, mm-hmm. to mathematics, so on and so forth. But they also had to work. They had to do 3 hours a day of manual labor. They had to help remove the rocks from the fields, sure. build the fences, do all of that sort of thing. They did not build the college building. There was a contractor
sure.
who was hired to do that. But all the field work, that's mm-hmm. what the boys did.
Okay.
And they were fairly young. You had to be 16 years old, and a lot of them were 16 when they came here. They were pretty young. But
this was against a backdrop of the Civil War, which we'll get to in
yes,
just a minute.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right now, if you're just joining us, I want to mention this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Carolyn Donaldson. I'm joined by Roger Williams, who was the director of the Penn State Alumni Association for many years and now author of Evan Pugh's Penn State, America's Model Agricultural College, that was published by Penn State University Press. Thanks again for joining us. So let's look at another side of President Pugh, Dr. Pugh. He worked as a lobbyist to be able to struggle. The struggling school had to get money, so he worked there. And also he had some professional personal connections. He fell in love while he was here, too. I have to bring that up because I think that's a beautiful part of your story.
He did. He fell head over heels, love at first sight. When he went to Bellefonte shortly after he arrived here as president, and he wanted to meet with Abram Valentine. Valentine was the local ironmaster in Bellefonte, was president of the Valentine and Thomas Iron Works. Mm-hmm. So he went to their home at Willowbank, and there he saw Rebecca Valentine, who was probably in her late 20s at that point. And as Pugh later recounted it, they fell in love at first sight. So they became engaged eventually. And they married in February of 1864, but it was probably a 3 to 4 year engagement, if you will.
And then a very short marriage, which we talked about there, unfortunately. And he built not only helped finish, of course, what is now Penn State, but the president's house, which he never was able to live in, but thought that he better make provisions for his wife in the future.
Absolutely. When he got here, basically, there were a few outbuildings, including a barn, but the college was the college building, and the college building was the college. Everything was in this building. I mean, faculty apartments, if you will. The students lived there. It was a dormitory, museums, auditoriums, classrooms, laboratories, but not really a place to bring a future wife. So Pugh, with the Board of Trustees, said, we need to build a house, not only for me, but for succeeding presidents as well. And so he said, I will commit one-third of the cost, which was $1,000, if the trustees would match it with $2,000. And they agreed to do that. Mm-hmm. So construction started. Pugh himself pitched in and did some of the work digging in the basement, if you will. But the house was not completed until shortly after he died in late April of 1864. But the house stands there today. It's now part of the Hintz Family Alumni Center. It looks a little bit different than it might have by the time it was finished. There's a beautiful Gone with the Wind porch, if you will, with massive columns. But that was part of his legacy as well. And the Alumni Association still uses that building to this day. That's where the staff of the Penn Stater is happily ensconced.
That's wonderful. Great, rich history. Okay, back to the mechanics, though, of this genius, this visionary. He lobbied first on behalf of the state to get funding, and again on the federal level for the Morrell Act, and then the funding came back to Pennsylvania. But he was doing all this to formulate this larger model of what he felt should be the vision.
He was. As we had talked about previously, when he came here, the building was one-third finished. And boy, he was fixated on getting that thing completed because part of it was he wanted a relatively large college. He didn't think an agricultural college could succeed as a small school. Mm-hmm. So he needed to get it done. The college building, as it was designed, would house 330 students, if you will, 165 dormitory rooms. So his first order of business in 1861 was to lobby the state for an appropriation of $50,000 to complete the structure. And he got it. The legislature passed it the week that the Confederates fired on Fort Sumter. So that enabled construction to resume, although, you know, a lot of men and material went to war, so it was a slow process getting the thing completed. But that was very important. His other major legislative accomplishment was, of course, working with his allies, his Board of Trustees, his congressional representatives to get the Morrell Land Grant College Act passed. This was probably one of the most important bills, certainly in American higher education history, but it had implications for the entire society because this was designed to provide federal land. The idea was you sold it off and you used the money to establish an endowment. And with that endowment, you would establish at least one college in every state whose purpose would be, without excluding scientific and classical studies and including military tactics, to teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanic arts, which we now call engineering. Wow. And of course, that really provided the enabling legislation for the American land-grant colleges and universities.
We still have today.
And we work at one At least I used to work at one. You're still working at one.
Absolutely. Yes. That's amazing, his vision. And he worked beyond the Pennsylvania Agricultural College, too, because he worked with other organizations and other colleges, right, to say, this is good for all of us. You know, let's get this
going. In fact, for the federal government, for the U.S. Bureau of Agriculture, he was asked to do a study of land-grant colleges or agricultural colleges that were trying to get up and running, which he did. And he also advised the Bureau of Agriculture, which was transitioning to become the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in terms of what it needs to do, what its research agenda should be, how it should be structured. And Carolyn, he was twice offered the post of being chief chemist for the United States, for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Twice he turned it down. He said, my duty and my destiny lie here. You know, it's wonderful to be considered for this, but we're going to get this college built, and it is going to be the national model.
Unbelievable. You talk about the Civil War going on simultaneously, and there was an ebb and flow of students and resources. And at one point, it was a pretty low population base at what was the Pennsylvania Agricultural College, but he worked around that.
Yeah. Well, you raise a really interesting point. I mean, Pugh was accomplishing all this in the midst of the greatest crisis in American history, the American Civil War. And one of the challenges he had, of course, was trying to keep the young men in college as Lincoln was calling for volunteers. And Pugh was fairly successful doing that. But, of course, in June of 1863, you have Lee's Army of Northern Virginia invading the Keystone State. And Lincoln put out a call for 100,000 more volunteers. The governor of the state, Andrew Curtin, backed it up. And the college nearly emptied out. It did not close down entirely, but it nearly emptied out. And Pugh later said he wished he could have done more to keep them here because he thought, you know, these are boys. They aren't going to be able to do a whole lot. And especially sending them in to go up against the grizzled veterans of the Army of Northern Virginia, that was not a wise move. Most, you know, of course, the happy ending is that the Confederates were turned back at Gettysburg and most of the boys came back to the campus by mid-August of 1863.
When we talk about the science behind his program, that was always key for him, right, as a scientist himself.
Yeah. I mean, he was committed to ensuring that agriculture be infused with a scientific basis. You know, a lot of agricultural practices going back to the origins of this country were based on, you know, planting according to the phases of the moon, some superstitions such as, you know, if there were a lot of spiders in the barn in the spring, that foretold a lot of happy cattle births, if you will.
That's right.
And the whole idea was to inject science into agriculture. One of the great problems that America faced as the decades wore on was soil exhaustion.
That's what I was trying to find a reference in your book. You talk about that, or he wrote about that. That was
He did. And what he wanted to do essentially was to ensure that the soil was being replenished in such a way that nutrients could continue to support agriculture. I mean, there were a lot of abandoned farms in New England and even in Pennsylvania as people moved west to the fertile lands of the upper Midwest and Midwest.
And when we look at agriculture at that time, it was clearly the largest industry.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, beyond anything, 82%, you said.
Absolutely. More than 8 in 10 Americans lived in rural areas, and most of them were farmers as late as 1850. So there was a vast agricultural constituency, yes.
Would you then say that Dr. Pugh definitely enhanced the American soil in essence with his scientific approach and molding young people to be able to learn about this?
Yes, that's exactly what he wanted to do. You know, if you're going to inject science into agriculture, you have to have people who are comfortable and familiar and able to do exactly that. And the way you do it is you basically incorporate that in the curriculum of agricultural colleges. That's where you start to do that. So that was his goal in life, and he largely succeeded.
The book is written from your perspective of researching, but also from his words, so many of his words, a prolific writer. And we have his works here also on campus, I understand, right? We have those protected?
We have the Evan Pugh papers are in the Eberle Family Special Collections Library, which is in the university libraries, and about 5,000 pages. Pugh was a voluminous writer. And Carolyn, you still are a journalist in many respects. And Pugh was actually a journalist as well. In his younger days, he wrote for the Westchester paper, and he sent dispatches back from Germany to American newspapers in New York, the New York Herald Tribune and others. And he was as gifted with the written word as he was with scientific apparatus. I mean, he was an astute observer. And he basically conjured up a unique method of taking shorthand. He used Pittman shorthand, and he also adapted it to his own purposes. So he was able to take notes accurately and voluminously, copiously. I mean, he was an active writer.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And your book reflects a lot of those very important points. We've got just a few minutes left, so I want to move towards the legacy of Dr. Pugh, of the first president of what is now Penn State. What, after doing all of this and having this book published, what is your feel for his legacy? What is the most important things that you want people to take away from this book?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of Penn Staters can take pride in the fact that he accomplished very quickly what he set out to do, to create the world's biggest, certainly the world's biggest and best institution of scientific agriculture, at least on American shores. He did that. Now, the tragedy is that he died young, age 36, and then Penn State went into an 18-year period of retrogression, if you will, and we devolved into kind of a backwoods classical college until George Atherton came here in 1882 and got us back on track, according to the dictates of the Morrill Land-Grant College Act. But you ask what his legacy is today. Basically, he established the high academic standard for this institution. And you see that reflected in such things as the Evan Pugh professorships at Penn State. I think we have 32 active Evan Pugh professors. This was set up in 1960 to reward the most creative, the most prolific researchers in the respective disciplines at this university. That's part of it. But I think what I look at when I think about Evan Pugh is this entire university. I mean, look at it today. A grand scale, 24 campuses, 100,000 students, 42,000 faculty and staff. So the grand scale that Pugh wanted for this institution now exists. The reputation, he established this place as number one, if you want to use today's vernacular. There are a number of other legacies. You find them in Old Main, as you pointed out previously, but I think his legacy is the university that we have today. You know, look at it, 24 campuses, 100,000 students, 42,000 faculty and staff, and a reputation as one of the world's great teeming cities of science and intellect. The Center for World University Rankings came out just a couple of weeks ago and placed Penn State 43rd in the world. There are 27,000 colleges and universities on planet Earth, Carolyn, and to be 43rd, to be in that ranking is astounding. So to me, Evan Pugh's legacy is the same epitaph that you find in Christopher Wren's grave. He was the architect who rebuilt London after the Great Fire. It's basically this: if you seek his monument, look around you.
Beautiful words. Roger Williams, thanks so much for joining us today. It's published by Penn State University Press, Evan Pugh's Penn State, America's Model Agricultural College, available in bookstores and online. For Take Note, I'm Carolyn Donaldson.